Joseph Banks. His name, of course, echoes in Bankstown, the electorate, and also in an airport. But we know him best as president of the famous Royal Society in London for over 41 years, and the fact that he brought over 30,000 plant specimens home with him, 1,400 of which he personally discovered. He was also a famous philanderer, and as we will reveal shortly, may have been England's first marijuana dealer. Grantley Kaiser, award-winning journo, is the author of 17 books, including Macquarie, Banjo, Mrs. Kelly and Monash, and his newie about Banks is called simply Banks. Grantley, welcome to the Little Wireless Program.
Oh, good evening, Phil. Thank you very much for having me. Certainly a remarkable man, Joseph Banks.
Look, let's deal with the salacious suggestion that he gave marijuana to Samuel Coleridge. Can we just sort of get that out of the way? It can't be true.
Well, it is true. Banks, of course, had scientific advisors and plant collectors working for him around the world in his capacity as president of the Royal Society. One of them was a famous Scottish doctor named Helena Scott, who was in Bombay, and he wrote to Banks to say that the locals there were using the plant Cannabis indica as a narcotic in place of opium. And at the same time, Banks was also getting information from his shipmate aboard the Endeavour, who was Joseph Matra, after whom Matraville is named. And Matra was working as a consul in Tangier, and he was sending Banks flasks of Cannabis indica in the form of hashish from Tangier. So Banks was getting information and supplies from two parts of the world. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who was an opium addict and a very, very great writer, had a friend named Thomas Wedgwood, son of the master potter, and the younger Wedgwood was in great physical pain. So Banks recommended that maybe some of this cannabis might help his ailments. And so it was that Coleridge wrote that there's a substance called the Indian hemp, which the locals call bang or bangi. It's a drug that, in his words, sent people pretty much around the twist, but Banks was able to supply it to them to help ease the guy's pain. So in that case, Banks was probably officially the first cannabis supplier in Britain.
Grantley, you realise that this revelation of yours means we have to strip the name Banks off Bankstown.
We rip can't. Off out all the suches, yeah.
Dear. Now, tell me about how privileged he was at birth.
Well, very much so. He came from generations of money. One of his ancestors was quite a prominent solicitor and a great friend of the aristocracy. And over the generations, the fortune that man made, Joseph Banks the First, just snowballed, so that by the time Banks was 21 and inherited a fortune from his late father, he had an income that was very much in today's terms a multi-million dollar annual income at the age of 21. He also owned an estate called Reevesby, which gives its name to the Sydney suburb of Reevesby. He had a country estate called Reevesby. And Banks, unlike many of his friends, I mean, Banks loved to have a good time. He was a very lusty young man, and he was known as the bedbreaker of Oxford. Such was his playboy reputation.
But unlike Please, a lot I, of his I friends, can't handle them. This is deeply shocking. Deeply shocking.
But unlike a lot of his friends who just squandered away their money or lived lives of total debauchery in those days, Banks's great passion was for science, and he wanted to educate not just himself but the whole world about the marvels of the natural world around him. So from a very young age, Banks was learning and studying as much as he could about natural science, and he really put his money where his mouth was in helping to fund that expedition of Cook's on the Endeavour.
Now, he studied at school and university, but and we're talking Harrow, Eton,
yep.
Oxford,
yep.
but
yep.
He wasn't a natural scholar.
No, he was a poor student by the standards of the time. It was said his schoolmates said that the problem was that he always was outdoors. He loved playing sports of the time. He loved fishing, and he loved walking in the woods. His whole passion from probably his early teenage years was learning about the natural world, plants and animals. They just absolutely fascinated him. And it became such that Banks was sort of seen as his younger days at school as a bit of a buffoon. But by the time he left school, It was said that anybody that wanted to know anything about plants or animals, they went to see Mr. Banks because he knew all about them. And for the rest of his life, that was Banks's great passion, was learning about the natural world, natural science.
To get a feeling for the times, I'd like you, in parenthesis, to tell us a story about that tradition at Harrow, which, displays the barbarity of the time.
The annual ram hunt, yeah. The kids would chase a ram around the schoolyard, beating it to death with clubs, and it became a much longed for tradition every year at those public schools. But by the time that Banks came along, it was coming out. But these were barbaric times, and Banks sort of I guess he ushered in an era, and people of his ilk ushered in an era of much more civilization as far as learning was concerned. So that a lot of those public schools did become eventually centres of great learning. And certainly Banks did more than just about anybody to promote the study of science in Britain for more than half a century.
Now, at the time of COVID, it's relevant to point out that at the age of 17, he was inoculated against smallpox.
Yeah. And quite a dangerous procedure in those days too. They became very, very sick. The first inoculation that he had against smallpox, it was a revolutionary process at the time, but it still could be very, very dangerous and life-threatening. And Banks became very ill at the first time, so it ended his school days. He ended his school days prematurely, and finally, he was given another inoculation of smallpox that worked. But Banks was a really hardy soul, and one of the things writing the book just gave me such an appreciation of his courage and his resourcefulness. He was a young guy who was fabulously wealthy, and yet he really thought nothing. He really looked forward to getting on a small ship to. The first great expedition he took was to North America, the wilds of northeastern Canada, Nova, Labrador and Newfoundland and those areas, you know, amongst the Eskimo and the British and French fishermen up there studying the plants and animals of the subarctic area. You know, he had no fear at all of risking his life and taking on these really hazardous conditions. And then a couple of years later, he joins Cook's voyage to on the Endeavour.
Slow it up a bit, because let's make the point that before he arrives at what would become Botany Bay, at just 27, he'd seen the Venus transit across the sun. Yep. He'd undergone the painful ordeal of a Polynesian tattoo.
Yep.
He'd eaten dolphin and dog and seagull and crow. But amazing. I didn't realise he'd also had an encounter with cannibalism in New Zealand.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And he was quite startled. He was in great awe of the Maori warriors. They had a number of skirmishes when the only previous European contact with the Maori that was recorded was Abel Tasman, and some of his men got killed by Maoris who came out in canoes. So 150 years later, Cook and Banks turn up on the coast of New Zealand. They really don't know what to expect, except that they're likely to get a very hostile reception, which they did, and several of the Maori were killed in various skirmishes with Cook's men. But a sort of truce was created. Banks traded goods with the Maori and became in some ways friendly. They welcomed him into his villages, but they came upon one day a group of Maori on the beach eating human legs and arms, which of course startled Banks no end. And once he got over the revulsion, though, the scientific brain kicked in, and he wanted to take some Maori heads back as souvenirs of some of the warriors who'd been killed in battle. And he managed to swap a pair of his old linen underpants for a Maori head, because the Maori put a great prize on English cloth, the linen cloth. So Banks did a deal, a pair of underpants for a human head.
I must say my enthusiasm for Joe is ebbing away with that story, but let's talk about his first encounters with first Australians, because it's really interesting. You write that the Aboriginal people completely ignored the Europeans when they came across them, but became frightened when approached.
Well, it's strange, you know, when the Endeavour first sailed into what's now Botany Bay, the Aboriginal people more or less turned their backs to some extent, and just as though they were hoping they would go away. But when Cook and Banks actually made it to shore, they were met with a very hostile reception. Two warriors came out from the large group and were brandishing their spears and threw spears at Cook and his men. And Cook replied, as was the British way, whenever there was some sort of confrontation with gunfire. And Cook actually shot one of the Aboriginal men in the legs with birdshot, light birdshot, which was meant to sting rather than kill. So it was a very, very hostile reception for Banks and Cook. But they managed to stay in Botany Bay for a little over a week. The Aboriginal people kept their distance. Banks really couldn't get to see very much of them because they were very wary of the British, as is understandable after this first melee. But Banks spent more than a week traversing over what's now Sydney, looking at the various parts of Sydney and collecting as much fauna and flora as he could. He was quite astonished by the great amount of wildlife and especially sea life that they found in Botany Bay. And
I love that. We haven't got a huge amount of time, and I love that little story that when he comes across a tree that's got a slight flesh wound, he looks at the gum and then calls it a gum tree.
Yeah, because it had gum coming out of it, yeah. It's amazing. He took back more than 30,000 botanical and zoological samples from that Endeavour voyage. You know, he really did astound Britain and Europe with the things that they brought back, including the carcass of a kangaroo. Banks called it a giant hopping mouse and was quite amazed by the sight of these things leaping through the bush. And he really brought Europe to a knowledge of a world that none of them, no one in Europe really knew anything about what was down in the South Pacific until Banks returned home.
Grant Lee, let's talk about the way he ignored the bonk ban.
he was a very amorous man, Banks. He was a young guy with a lot of girlfriends in England, and when he got to Tahiti, he was quite, even though he was certainly not shy in sexual matters, he was quite astounded by some of the Tahitian customs of lovemaking, and he was very, very keen to sample some for himself. But one of the things that he was also very keen to introduce into Tahitian way of life was kissing on the lips. He said that the Tahitian women had never seen this sort of thing or experienced this sort of thing before, so he was very keen to show, especially the beautiful ones, the ones that really took his fancy. He was very keen to show them how to kiss on the lips. And he gave a speech about this once in London, at which Benjamin Franklin, the great American statesman and scientist, was present. And Franklin went home with stories to tell the Americans about this man, Joseph Banks, who had taught the Tahitians how to kiss on the lips. So Banks, everywhere he went, he was doing his best to satisfy his great sexual appetite.
I don't want to emphasize the salacious, but as we run out of time, would you tell me about how he once took a woman dressed as a man to sea?
Yeah, that was remarkable. He was supposed to take a part on Cook's second voyage to the Pacific, and he had one of his girlfriends dressed as a man, all set to join the fleet in Madeira, but Banks had a hissy fit on the wharf as they were supposed to leave, and decided not to go on the voyage with Cook. But no one got the message to his girlfriend, who was dressed as a man, who was Mr. Barrett, who was Cook was quite amazed at this man waiting to join the fleet. He said that he dresses like a man, but in all other ways is certainly a woman. So Banks had very surreptitiously tried to get his girlfriend on the voyage to the Pacific, but didn't quite work out that way.
A final question is, how did Banks end up?
Well, he ended up very rich and very prosperous. He was the boss of the president of the Royal Society in Britain for more than 40 years. So predominantly, he was the chief scientist in England for almost half a century, and he presided over so many great voyages of discovery around the world. Everything that every voyage of exploration that took place from Europe was really on Banks's say-so, and as far as the settling of Australia, it was on his say-so that the first fleet took off for Australia in 1787, arriving in 1788.
And on that note, we shall take our our leave of Joseph Banks and indeed of you, Grantley. That's thanks for coming on. Grantley,
thank you very much for
Grantley
having
Kaiser,
me.
Award-winning journo, author of 17 books, including Macquarie, Banjo, Mrs. Kelly, and Monash.